Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're diving headfirst into a truly remarkable book, Calm Wolf's The Right Stuff.
Absolutely. It's just fantastic.
It really is. It's this sprawling, immersive narrative. It covers the early days of military test pilots and, of course, the legendary Mercury 7 astronauts.
But it's so much more than just a history of NASA, isn't it?
Exactly. Wolf takes us deep into, well, human psychology, the nature of courage, and how we as a culture kind of create myths around our heroes. It's brilliant.
It is. And Tom Wolfe himself, well, he lived from 1930 to 2018, a real literary force. He was a pioneer, an American author and journalist, one of the founders of what they called new journalism.
Right, using novel techniques for nonfiction.
Precisely. Like scene-by-scene construction, lots of dialogue, making nonfiction read like, well, like a novel. And his background, his PhD in American studies, gave him this incredible lens to dissect, you know, unspoken social codes, the whole psychological landscape.
You see it in his other big books, too, like The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test or The Bonfire of the Vanities, that sharp eye for culture.
Definitely. He just had a knack for capturing the essence of a moment, a subculture.
And you know what strikes me is how relevant The Right Stuff still feels, even though it's about events decades ago.
Yeah, it really holds up.
It's not just recounting facts. It really deconstructs what heroism even is. It looks at performance under intense, almost unbelievable pressure and the power of the media in shaping how we see things.
And it asks that fundamental question.
Yeah. What kind of person straps themselves to basically a controlled explosion? And then how does society take that person and turn them into this icon? It's the human story behind the space race.
Damn.
Fascinating stuff. So to really get this concept of the right stuff, we actually need to go back before the rockets, right? To the Mojave Desert.
That's the key. Edwards Air Force Base. Wolf paints it almost as a, well, a cathedral, he calls it, where this right stuff was practiced almost like a religion.
A tough place.
Well, incredibly tough. A world of test pilots just pushing experimental planes to the absolute edge every single day. Death was... Well, it was just part of the environment. Funerals were common.
Grim.
And the right stuff itself.
Yeah.
It wasn't something written down. It was this unwritten, almost mystical code. A mix of supreme confidence, amazing technical skill, keeping your emotions totally buttoned down, and this sort of fatalistic acceptance that things could go wrong at any second.
You couldn't learn it in a classroom?
No way. You had to show it, demonstrate it, usually under incredible stress in the cockpit.
And the ultimate example, the sort of high priest of all this, was Chuck Yeager.
Oh, absolutely. The archetype. Wolf's description of his 1947 flight, breaking the sound barrier in the Bell X-1, it's legendary.
The detail about the broken ribs.
Right. Two broken ribs, kept it completely secret from the brass, and that calm, laconic pilot's voice over the radio, even when things got hairy, that was it. That was the proof.
Understated courage.
Exactly. And within that world at Edwards, there was this unspoken hierarchy, what Wolf termed the pyramid of skill. Pilots were constantly trying to climb it.
Not for fame, though.
No, not for public fame. It was about earning respect from the other pilots. Peer validation. That was the ultimate prize in that culture.
Okay, so you have this intense closed world at Edwards. But then something massive happens on the world stage that just throws everything into disarray.
Right. And that, of course, was Sputnik, October 1957. The Soviets launched the first satellite.
Which sent shockwaves to the U.S.
Total shockwaves. Cold War paranoia just spiked. National humiliation. Suddenly, space wasn't just science anymore. It was a battlefield, a political imperative. This kicked off the space race and the urgent need for an American space program. NASA was born out of that urgency.
And suddenly they needed astronauts.
Yep. The call went out. Specific criteria. Male, under 40, under 5'11", jet pilot experience, engineering or science degree.
But here's the irony Wolf points out, right? They weren't necessarily grabbing the guys at the very top of that Edwards pyramid.
Not exactly. They needed guys who were, yes, skilled, but also incredibly resilient, physically and psychologically. People who could endure the completely unknown stresses of spaceflight, almost like test subjects initially.
It must have been tough for these pilots' identities.
Hugely challenging. Wolf describes the selection process, the tests at the Lovelace Clinic. I mean, some of it sounds almost bizarre, definitely invasive.
Humiliating, even.
Yeah, you could say that. These guys, masters of multi-million dollar jets, were suddenly being treated like passive lab rats, poked, prodded endlessly. It tested their endurance, their ability to just take it, More than their flying skills in some ways.
But seven guys made it through. The Mercury Seven.
That's right. Alan Shepard, Gus Grissom, John Glenn, Scott Carpenter, Wally Shearer, Gordon Cooper, and Deke Slayton. And boom, instant national heroes. Literally overnight.
And that fame wasn't just organic, was it?
Not at all. Wolf really highlights the Life magazine contract. A massive deal, $500,000 back then. It essentially turned their private lives, their families' lives, into this sanitized perfect public image, managed carefully by NASA's PR team.
America needed heroes for the Cold War narrative.
Precisely. And that put incredible strain, as Wolf shows, on their wives, Annie Glenn, Trudy Cooper, Louise Shepard. They're expected to be these flawless, supportive figures, always smiling for the cameras, even while, you know, terrified inside.
Another unwritten contract.
A heavy one. But for the astronauts themselves, maybe the biggest fight was against what they called the spam-in-a-can approach.
Nanning.
Meaning the early Mercury capsule designs basically treated them like cargo.
Yeah.
Automated systems. No real pilot input needed. Just sit there.
Which, for these guys, was an insult.
A fundamental insult to their identity as pilots. This was an existential battle for them. They weren't just specimens.
So they pushed back.
Hard. They banded together, demanded changes, a window to see out of, manual controls, the ability to actually fly the spacecraft.
And they won that fight.
They did. And it was crucial. It cemented their role as pilots, as active participants, not just passengers. It really shaped how the whole space program moved forward and how we perceived their heroism.
Okay, so they established themselves as pilots. How did this right stuff actually play out during the missions themselves?
Oh, it was front and center. Think about Alan Shepard's flight, May 1961. First American in space to suborbital. But during those long countdown delays, what did he say?
Let's light this candle.
Exactly, the kind of gruff, calm, under-pressure attitude. Pure right stuff.
Then you have Gus Grissom's flight, the Liberty Bell 7. Wolf presents that one as more complicated, almost tragic.
Yeah, the flight itself was fine, another suborbital hop.
Yeah.
But after splashdown, the hatch blew off prematurely, the capsule sank. Grissom got out okay, but...
But the whispers started. Did he panic? Did he screw the pooch, as they say?
Exactly. That phrase haunted him. It just shows that razor-thin line between hero and, well, perceived failure. Even if it was mechanical, the suspicion lingered. The pressure was immense.
And then the big one, John Glenn.
The climax, really. February 1962, first American to orbit the Earth. Wolf's description is incredible, the strange fireflies Glenn saw outside the capsule.
And the heat shield problem.
Terrifying. Mission Control thought the heat shield might be loose. He could have burned up on reentry. But Glenn, utterly calm throughout, that cemented his image as the ultimate embodiment of the right stuff for the public.
So Project Mercury really did create this new kind of hero, the celebrity warrior.
It absolutely did. But Wolf makes a point of circling back, doesn't he?
To Yeager.
Back to Yeager. Still at Edwards, far from the Life magazine cameras, still pushing the envelope in experimental aircraft. Wolf includes this harrowing scene where Yeager nearly dies testing the NF-104 Starfighter, basically a rocket with wings.
His heroism stayed private, professional.
Exactly. A stark contrast to the kind of manufactured public fame the astronauts experienced. It highlights that difference, the internal code versus the one shaped for public consumption.
Okay, so we've seen it in action. If we try to distill it, what was the core philosophy here? What really drove these guys beyond just patriotism?
Well, at its heart, the right stuff was this intense blend. You needed incredible skill, yes, but also raw bravery. And that crucial grace under pressure, the ability to stay cool, use that pilot's voice when everything's going wrong.
And suppressing emotion, being fatalistic.
That too. A learned ability to compartmentalize fear. To accept that death was a real possibility, just part of the job description. But what drove them? Wolf suggests it wasn't just duty. It was validation from their peers, climbing that pyramid of skill.
Being the best among the best.
Right. The deep satisfaction of mastering these incredibly dangerous machines, mastering yourself against the odds. Professional pride, maybe, at its most intense.
So it's important to stress this isn't about not feeling fear.
No, not at all. That's a key insight from Wolf. The right stuff isn't the absence of fear. It's the learned ability to manage it, control it, compartmentalize it, to function perfectly even when your gut is screaming panic.
Discipline and mental strength.
Exactly. And their purpose, you could say, was twofold. Push the limits of what humans and machines could do, and for the astronauts especially, fight to maintain their identity as pilots against a system that initially wanted to treat them like, well...
Spam in a can.
Spam in a can.
You know,
Looking back, every great story seems to have these moments, these turning points that just change everything. For this story, what were they?
I think you can identify three really pivotal ones. First, you have to go back to Yeager breaking the sound barrier in 47.
We talked about the flight itself, but why was it transformative?
Because it didn't just happen. It codified that raw, authentic, right stuff at Edwards. Yeager's actions, his quiet courage, set the standard. It created the archetype bravery for your peers, not for headlines. That was the foundation.
Okay, that makes sense. Point one, what's next?
Point two has to be Sputnik in 57. The shock, the panic.
We covered that too, but the transformation there.
The transformation was profound. It yanked space exploration out of the realm of pure science and test piloting and threw it right into the Cold War arena. It became political, a propaganda battle, and that completely shifted the focus. Suddenly, it wasn't just about finding the best pilot, it was about finding heroes the media could sell to the public. The criteria changed, the expectations changed, the internal code met this massive external pressure.
Right, the context totally shifted. And the third turning point.
I'd say it was the astronauts' fight against being spam in a can. Remember, they found out the early designs basically made them passengers.
And they fought back.
They united and fought back for manual controls, for a window, for an active role. Why was this transformative? Because it redefined what an astronaut was.
They asserted their agency.
Exactly. They ensured they were seen as pilots, as active participants, not just biological specimens along for the ride. It was this assertion of human skill and control against the seemingly overwhelming tide of automation and bureaucracy. It fundamentally shaped NASA's approach afterwards and cemented their heroic image as pilots.
Those are three huge shifts. So bringing it all forward, what does this story, these lives, mean for us today? What are the takeaways?
Well, one obvious lesson is about performing under pressure. I mean, the whole book is practically a case study in the psychology of handling high-stakes situations.
And the key being not the absence of fear.
But the discipline management of it, which, if you think about it, applies way beyond test pilots or astronauts, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Anyone in a high-stress job, surgeons, first responders, leaders making tough calls, even just managing a really challenging project at work, it's about building those mental frameworks, staying focused.
Another big one is navigating bureaucracy, that whole spam in a can fight. It's a classic example of individuals pushing back against a large system to assert their value, their expertise.
Which is something many people face, right? How do you make sure your skills aren't overlooked or devalued when the system, or maybe technology, seems to be making you just a cog in the machine?
It's about advocating for your contribution, refusing to be made redundant. And a third lesson, maybe a more personal one, comes from looking at the astronaut wives.
The hidden burdens.
Exactly. Their sacrifices really highlight the unseen pressures and the personal costs that can come with that kind of high-profile success and achievement.
It makes you think about success differently, maybe more holistically, recognizing the toll it can take, appreciating the support systems that are often invisible behind public figures. Heroism isn't free.
Not at all. There's always a human cost.
Okay, so to kind of wrap this up, let's try and crystallize three final takeaways from our deep dive into the right stuff.
All right. First, maybe an emotional insight. Real heroism, and maybe big historical leaps in general, they're not just about technology or ambition. They're driven by the messy, complex, sometimes contradictory psychology of the people involved. And heroism itself is this blend, part real courage, part social construction, maybe part luck.
Okay, that's powerful. What about intellectually?
An intellectual insight. Exceptional achievement rarely comes from just one thing. It's usually at the intersection of natural talent, intense preparation, and that crucial psychological ability to perform when it counts. True excellence needs the whole package. Technical skill, emotional control, even understanding the cultural context you're in.
Makes sense. And finally, a universal takeaway.
A universal insight. Performance under pressure isn't about being fearless. It's about the disciplined management of fear. That's a skill. And it's applicable far beyond the cockpit. It applies to almost any high-stakes challenge, personal or professional. It reminds us that it's often those core human qualities that let us push past what seems possible.
Fantastic insights. A truly remarkable book and story. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accatra Foundation.